The Box. From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call. Stay with Dr. Barry Dworkin for the next 2 hours, and we guarantee you'll go away learning at least one new thing to keep you on the road to better health. Here's your host, Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to the October 28th, 2007 edition of Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. I'm broadcasting live on 1070 CFAX in Victoria, 1290 CFRW in Winnipeg, AM 800 CKLW in Windsor, 1050 Chum in Toronto, and from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa. And this week we're going to be looking at a new surgical procedure that is transforming the lives of patients too sick to undergo conventional treatment to replace diseased aortic valves. Aortic valves are valves found in the heart. They're found between the left ventricle and the aorta. This is the major area of the heart that pumps blood out into the rest of the body. And for some people, these valves get narrowed. They get calcified, they get deposits on them, they stiffen up, and the valves essentially tighten. The space in that valve gets smaller, and it gets much more difficult for people to be able to receive oxygenated blood throughout their body, and they tend to get very tired very quickly. Walking up the stairs, they get short of breath. Even just getting out of bed for people who have severe, what we call aortic stenosis, is a very debilitating condition. And there are some people who have diseases along with those, or concurrent or comorbid states, that make it very difficult for these people to have surgery, the conventional surgery. Excuse me. So there is in the at St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver a new technique that is being done that is called percutaneous aortic valve replacement, and we'll be getting into that with Dr. Robert Boone. He's an interventional cardiology fellow at the Heart Center of St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver, where they are pioneering this new specific surgical procedure. And as well, is there a point when treatment for Alzheimer's disease should be discontinued because of a lack of benefit? A lot of times we tend to continue with medications throughout the person's life who has had a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. What are the medications that are being used? What are their indications? And is there a point really where they just don't work very well anymore based on the evidence that we know, and they should be discontinued? And that will be coming up with Dr. Paula Rochon, senior scientist at the Institute for Clinical and Evaluative Sciences, in just a few moments. As well, we'll be taking your calls at 1-800-580-2372, 1-800-580-2372, in the second hour of our show. There are several Alzheimer's disease medications that are used to slow the decline of memory, language, and thinking abilities. A study published in the October issue of the Journal of the American Geriatric Society by the Institute for Clinical Evaluative Sciences, or the ICES, sought to answer several questions regarding the duration of therapy, whether there is a point when treatment should be discontinued because of a lack of benefit, and how doctors use these medications. Dr. Paula Rochon is senior scientist at the ICES, scientist and staff geriatrician and assistant director of the Kunin-Lunenfeld Applied Research Unit at Baycrest Hospital, professor in the Division of Geriatric Medicine at the University of Toronto, and senior author of this ICES study. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How many Canadians today suffer from Alzheimer's disease?
Well, Alzheimer's disease is a pretty common problem. I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of people who probably have this condition. It's very common.
What is the natural history of Alzheimer's? At what point do people start to see family or friends start to see changes that would make them think, you know, something is just not right?
Well, Alzheimer's is sort of a condition where you have problems with your memory and problems with your thinking. And it can start off with relatively sort of subtle things, but usually progresses over time.
What is the pathophysiology? What is it that's happening in the brain that is leading to this expression of the disease?
Well, generally it's considered that there's a degenerative process happening in the brain, so it's just not working as well as it did.
What medications are in use today to treat this condition? How do they actually work?
Well, the interesting part is that in the recent past, we have some medications that are being used to help manage some of the symptoms and problems that people experience with dementia, and in particular with Alzheimer's disease. And the kind of medications that are now on the market are called cholinesterase inhibitors, and they're drugs that are thought to be helpful in this situation.
How are they normally used? At what point during the development of Alzheimer's or during the course of the disease do they tend to work well?
Well, there's a little bit of debate about that, but I think for the most part, people have been using these drugs, starting them in people who have the milder forms of this kind of dementia.
How efficacious are they? So, for example, say someone has having problems with their memory, it's early on in their disease, and they use these medications. Does it improve the memory, or does it simply slow down the progression of memory difficulties?
Well, that's a big question. And so let's just say that in some people, when you try them, people, the patients themselves, and often family or people around them, will notice improvements. And sometimes the improvements can be subtle things, like people are a little bit more engaged, that they're remembering things a little bit better, that they're more alert, things like that. And so they're considered to be useful and beneficial in that kind of setting. For other people, they may not do that.
What was, when turn into your study, what was the basic research and basic science that led up to the development of your particular study? What was it that led you to create some questions that you wanted to answer?
Well, we were very interested in this because, for example, I'm a geriatrician, so I work with a lot of people who have various forms of dementia. And the lead author on this paper is a psychiatrist, also working in a similar kind of setting. And what we've seen over the years is that these medications are now being very widely used. And as we said earlier on, they were used primarily for people who had the milder or moderate forms of the dementia. But what we were interested in is looking at the idea of how are they being used? What's the pattern of their use? So, for example, I don't think that people had necessarily intended that these drugs should always be used indefinitely. And with this research, we were able to explore how they were being used. And what we were able to see is that there was a considerable number of things that we saw. One is that a number of people were using these drugs continually until the time that they died. And in other cases, people may even have been in palliative care type settings and were still using these medications. So it raises some questions, which I think we need to start thinking about.
So what were the specific findings? What did you uncover in your research?
Well, the one thing I talked about is that a number of people are using these medications long term. About 20% of the people in our sample were continuing on them until the time that they died. The other thing that we found that I think was really interesting is that there was about a third or more of people who were taking these medications were taking them at the same time as they were using other medications that might be considered to be inappropriate to use with these drugs, these cholinesterase inhibitors. So, for example, cholinesterase inhibitors, as we sort of described, the drugs that we're talking about, are meant to improve memory and make you more alert in people who have dementias like Alzheimer's disease. But at the same time, there's a large group of these people that were taking drugs like benzodiazepines, which would cause you to be drowsy and less alert, so therefore kind of counteracting the benefit of these drugs. And there was also people who were taking drugs that we call anticholinergics. And those are particularly problematic because they almost sort of have the opposite effect of the cholinesterase inhibitors, and so would really almost cancel out their effect. So one important message that we have is if you're going to use drugs like this, which could be very useful, you want to make sure you get the benefit. And if you're using them in combination with drugs, as we're seeing, that may not be beneficial and may sort of counteract these effects, that's something that needs to be changed.
So, in other words, does this imply in some way that the medications that are being prescribed or the polypharmacy that's being involved, that there's no systematic review of the interactions of these medications, or does it imply, or does it imply that when it is being prescribed, when the anticholinesterase or the cholinesterase inhibitors are being prescribed, that there isn't an understanding of how the medications interact, or that no thought is given to, well, what are the medications that person using?
Well, I think it's a lot of that. So maybe one, there's an educational issue that we may not think about these combinations being not good. And maybe there's a role, for example, for pharmacists and physicians to be thinking carefully about these combinations and, you know, deciding whether it's appropriate to be doing this. And often it probably isn't, or there's a better option out there.
So from this particular study, you mentioned a few of the clinical implications. Are there any recommendations that come from this as well? And also, do you plan to look at this issue a bit further, trying to fine-tune or look at other issues regarding the use of the medication? For example, providing information about when do you stop using the cholinesterase inhibitors? Is there a time where you finally decide, well, it's not going to be of benefit anymore?
So I think you have raised important points again, that this does lead to other areas of study. One is, I think an easy thing we can do is you shouldn't be giving cholinesterase inhibitors in combination with anticholinergic medications, because it sort of undoes their effect, and so we should make sure that we're not doing that kind of prescribing practice. That's something that we can look at right away. In terms of how long they should be used, I think the message is that we should continue these therapies as long as they're being beneficial. But if there comes a point when, and we need to continually reassess, are they still beneficial? And there be maybe a point in time when maybe the disease, the dementia has progressed to such a point where being on the cholinesterase inhibitors may not actually be the right thing to do. And I think it's important that we sit down and talk about, you know, is it still being helpful? If it is, then we should continue. And if it's not, then I think it's the time that you plan to discontinue. I don't think we've looked at those issues well enough.
Well, Dr. Roshan, I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time to discuss the importance behind looking at how medications are used in the treatment of Alzheimer's and determining not only the interactions with other medications, but also its efficacy over the course of the history of the disease, and being aware that these medications are not necessarily for use all the time up until the point the patient succumbs to their illness.
Thank you very much.
All the best.
Bye-bye.
Dr. Paula Rochon is Senior Scientist at the ICES, or Institute for Clinical and Evaluative Sciences, Scientist and Staff Geriatrician and Assistant Director of the Kunin-Lunenfeld Applied Research Unit at Baycrest Hospital, and Professor in the Division of Geriatric Medicine at the University of Toronto, and senior author of this ICES study. Coming up, some news updates and a book that I've been waiting for about a year and a half. I'd like to talk about that with you, since I've been blabbing about the previous one for the past year and a half. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you're listening to Sunday House Call.
You're listening to Dr. Barry Dworkin on Sunday House Call.